I think he was a teenager, perhaps 15 or 16, perhaps in his first year at Harvard, we're not sure because he burned his Harvard diaries, but he began to keep a diary, day in and day out, with the notable exception of a number of Saturdays, day in and day out, for the remainder of his life, insofar as we can tell, he kept that diary, with relentless kind of fidelity. Something I've tried to do that occasionally. Well, let's jot down something about what happens today, and we'll do it tomorrow, and then we'll do it the next day. And after about 3 days, I lose track. I don't think it's important. But part of it, day in and day out, week in and week out, summer and winter, harvest time, ecclesiastical council time, wedding time, Parkman kept this diary. Right up to the very end, when he falls ill in December of 1782, the diary has assumed such an importance in his life and apparently in his family's life, he's too weak to write in the diary. And one of his children, or a neighbor, it's not clear who steps forward, but you look in that diary and somebody writes entries into that diary. And then he seems to recover a bit. He regains, perhaps, his mental faculties. He regains his strength. And the handwriting comes back, and it's feeble, it's scraggly, it's terrible. And finally, you feel this man, it just disappears into a kind of illiterate blob. And the end is there. He dies about 2 weeks later. And you think, what was it that he had to say that was so important? He would call in somebody on his sickbed to write in that diary. Why did he get himself back up and turn to pen, quill and ink to write in the diary? And you look at those final entries, and they're not particularly interesting. What the weather was like, who visited him. There's a kind of momentum. It was a kind of, the way the horse gets in the traces, and the horse goes in. There he went, writing his diary. And so there's two problems with the man. He himself was not important, and most of the entries in the diary really don't tell us a lot. He doesn't have great commentaries on the American Revolution. He doesn't think deep philosophical thoughts about Jonathan Edwards' theology. He's not even terribly introspective. Who he visited? Who came and gave him a cheese? Did his wife go to the birth of a neighbor's child? What was the weather like? Did the ink freeze in his well? What book did he borrow? What newspaper did he read? And so on, through these many, many years. And that, perhaps, is one of the reasons why nobody has done a great deal with Ebenezer Parkman's diary. Back in the 1840s, a man named Joseph Tracy came across the diary, and we don't know how he got a hold of it, but he was writing the history of the Great Awakening. And Joseph Tracy got the diary, excerpted portions of it from 1742, and published a history of the Great Awakening. And that portion of the diary from 1742 simply disappeared until a couple of years ago. In 1899, the Westboro Historical Society engaged Harriet Merrifield Forbes, one of the great antiquarians and historians of the late 19th century, to transcribe selected portions, perhaps the only ones that they could get a hold of the diary, a few months from 1737, a few months from late 1778, 1779, and 1780. That was the end of it for another 60 years. And then in the 1960s, the American Antiquarian Society, which by that time had gotten hold of most of the manuscript, not all of it, because parts of it remained at the Massachusetts Historical Society, but the American Antiquarian Society started a grand program to publish the diary. And in their proceedings, you can see page after page after page. They began with the farthest back portions that they could reconstruct in 1719. And laboriously, Frank Ouellette of Worcester State College marched Parkman in his diary on up through 1755. And then, because of whatever reasons, the Antiquarian Society stopped, having published 1,000 pages of this diary. But there's 1756 and 1757 and 17 and so on down to 1782. I try to quantify this in some ways. And today I went, I got my 1 foot ruler out, and I went to the shelf where I have my transcriptions of the diary, and I measured things out to give you an idea in inches how large this thing is. The volumes in which I've kept the transcriptions measure about 30 inches. Well, what does 30 inches amount to? Well, it amounts to about 4,000 pages of diary. Well, 4,000 pages of a man talking about the weather and whether he's going to sell a cow and who came to visit and so on. And we asked, well, that's a lot. He's not Cotton Mather, he's not Judge Sewell, he's not George Washington. And there it sits. And the problem becomes, what does one do with it and why bother? Well, clearly back in the 1840s and then again in 1899 and then in the 1960s, people thought that this was a remarkable document. Now, in part, it was antiquarians and genealogists who really liked the thing. I'm not a member of the Maynard family, and I apologize if any of the Maynard family are here, but somebody eventually may want to know what happened to poor Mercy Maynard, and now we know. At least we know where she was in the 1770s. So it's very useful for tracking certain kinds of people down. But the problem is really a twofold one. Is the relentless regularity of this document, and how do you get a hold of it? How do you track, say, an individual or an idea through 4,000 pages? And I have to say that I started out originally in the late 1970s, before I had heard of computers or personal computers, and I began to say, well, let's take notes in this thing. And I would begin to take notes, and I'd think, oh, no, I can't do this. I had no idea exactly what that 30 inches would mean eventually when I got it all transcribed. But how do you take notes for something that's 4,000 pages long? So it was really only with the personal computer that you could begin to work with this thing in a systematic way. So when I prepared the little thing on Mercy Maynard as part of the handout today, I pulled the thing up on my screen. I asked the thing to search for Mercy Maynard, and it came up with an entry for his first visit to her. And then I began searching just Mercy because I thought I wouldn't find Mercy Maynard. And I came up with the four entries in about, less than 10 minutes. I knew that they were there. I'd seen them before, but it took me about 10 minutes to track.
Did you have a question?
Yes.
No.
How legible is this
document? To the 20th century uninitiated, they are terribly illegible. Once you get the rhythm of the document, as long as it's not torn or faded, it is quite legible. His spelling leaves something to be desired by our standards, his punctuation and the like, his forms of abbreviation, but you are blessed with not having seen my handwriting, but I can read his handwriting better than mine. I'm a left-handed writer, like, so so it is a quite legible document.
Are they all together in
chronological order? No, they got scattered after his death, and we really don't know in terms of provenance where they ended up. They were apparently scattered in town and then out of town, and I'll get to this in a minute. You know, somebody down in New Jersey came up with two of the volumes a couple of years ago. It would be the kind of thing, well, all right, five volumes to this relative, five volumes to that relative. They're in very small little booklets. They're not in anything that we have that we would associate with the kind of time.
Just
for
curiosity, we're talking about Mercy. What happened to Nathan?
Nathan is a relative of hers. The question is, what happens to Essence? No, Mercy was a single woman who conceived a child by Mr. Mason's Essex, that is, by a slave owned by a family in town. In other words, she was a woman, and she was born in 1725, so she is in her 30s by the time she conceives. Probably by that point, and we can only speculate, probably by that point, she was destined to be a spinster all of her life. Some kind of relationship emerged from perhaps, you can't speculate. A lonely woman, an isolated black man who had no prospects of ever having a wife. You have to speculate in those directions. And we don't know what happened to Essex. We don't know what happened to the infant.
Just getting back to the 20th century, have you input most of 4,000 pages?
Oh, yeah, I've got it all.
Get it all?
Sure.
Yeah.
Where do you think I've been the last 10 years? No, I put not only the manuscript portions in, but I've also put the published portions in so that I can pull this thing up on the screen in 10-year chunks. I'm working off a mainframe, by the way, so I'm not working off a PC. And so I can pull it up in a variety of compilations. I can create laboriously, but nonetheless, separate files. For example, I'm interested in such things as... when the Mrs. Parkmans are pregnant, at a certain point in their pregnancies, they are bled. So one of the things you look for, you ask the computer to search for such things as blood, bleed, and red. And you'll come up with a lot of other entries, but you'll come up with most of the instances in which his wife was bled by a physician midway through the pregnancy. Again, if one is looking for things about the sort of the everyday social fabric of life in a community, to know that at a certain point in a pregnancy, a woman was bled, then I think you're on to something that has potential significance for understanding the medical practices of the 18th century. So all of this is, yes, on the computer, as I say. I keep getting messages from our computer center, would you cut down your files, because I think I occupy about the mega, whatever they are, of this. So what we have in the diary is the sort of the everyday musings of a man who, first of all, is a minister. So the diary is filled with a lot of things having to do with his ministry. The sermons that he preaches on Sunday, or the sermons which he preaches at private meetings during the week, or special occasions like Thanksgivings or ordinations. We have information about who comes to visit him in times of crisis, that is, people who are concerned about the state of their souls. We have information about who he visits if they are in trouble, either spiritual or financial, or in the case of Mercy Maynard, morally in trouble. We have information about what he reads, or at least about the books and magazines and newspapers that come into his possession. We go with him to ecclesiastical councils where he attends the ordination or the dismissal of ministers. We have his concerns about Sabbath breaking, as people ride too late on a Saturday and break the Sabbath, or are found working on Sunday. We have records of baptisms of infants that are newborn and feared to die, and so people go and have a private baptism, as it were, at the house of the parents to have the child baptized before it dies. And so there's lots of information about his ministry. There's also lots of information about what we could call his second calling. That is, by profession, this man is a minister, but the good people of Westboro, like the good people of all towns in New England, never paid their minister sufficiently to allow him solely to be a minister. I don't think ministers ever been paid enough for that purpose. The parkman, like almost all ministers in colonial New England, was also a farmer. And so we have a great deal of information about this farm, about the crops that he puts in the field or has put in the field, because he does very little physical work himself. Information about the buying and selling of animals. Information about the construction of barns and sheds. Information about the fox, perhaps, or whatever it was that got in and killed the goose. Information about setting out seeds. Information about accidents. Information about the slaughtering of animals and so on. And so there's a great deal of information about the agricultural economy of central New England in the 18th century. There's also a great deal of information about his family, the birth of his children, quite obviously, the choice of names, the nursing and weaning of children, the work patterns, particularly of the boys as they grow older, the occasional instances of discipline where he has to rein his children in. The accidents and illnesses of all members of his family, relatives whom he visits, or relatives who come to stay for perhaps a night or perhaps a year in his household. And so we get a good sense of the family, but also the family in a larger sense, because by family, New Englanders meant what we would call household, that is, all the persons that were under family government. And so his family would include servants, his family would include other relatives. His family might include older persons who were living in his house. There's one example of a woman who lives in his home in the 1770s, and who's there apparently for better than 2 years, and as you search through the diary, there's perhaps a half dozen mentions of her coming and going. You don't have any idea where she eats. Well, I think she lived up in the third floor of the house, but I'm not certain. But it's some kind of accommodation. She was part of the family in the 1770s. The diary, not surprisingly, is a biased diary. It's written by a man. It's a man who moves in a man's world, and therefore most of what he writes about are other men or men's activities. And so we learn far more about his boys than we do about his girls. We learn far more about the workers that till his fields and bring in his crops than we do about the women who come into his household as servants or maids. So we have in the diary for the fabric, or the reconstruction of the fabric of the 18th century Westboro, and insofar as we can regard Westboro as typical of New England for 18th century New England, we have a marvelous kind of resource. And I told you something about the size of this diary, and I also want to tell you something about the particular years that, or a year that I'm going to be focusing on for the balance of my talk. As I've become more involved with working on this diary, I began to develop a list of the years which I would like to have recreated, you know, those that I would look on and somebody would pick it up or come down out of an attic or something like that. And I chose 2 years. I chose the year 1736 and the year 1742. I knew that back in the 1840s, Joseph Tracy had had his hands on the year 1742. I just knew he had. He had published it in his book. And then it disappeared. He didn't tell us where he got it. He just had it. 1742 is a dramatic year in New England in terms of the great religious revivals, and I wanted to know more about that year, 1742. My other favorite year on my list was 1736. Because it was in 1736 that Parkman's first wife, Molly, or Mary, dies. And I thought that had to be a year that would be loaded with emotional significance, loaded with the kind of personal decisions that a person would have to make in a time of severe family crisis. Well, I have an angel up there someplace, because 3 years ago, the American Antiquarian Society called me and told me that 2 years of the diary had turned up. A dealer down in New Jersey, who knows who he was, had purchased two years of the diary and was selling them to the American Antiquarian Society. And of course, as you might guess, 1742 and 1736. Somebody who ever thinks that you live under the right kinds of stars, clearly that was the year. And so what I'm doing this evening in talking about the courtship of Ebenezer Parkman and Hannah Breck is really to talk with you about a source that has been lost for perhaps two centuries. And if you go to the published version of the Ebenezer Parkman diary, which this library has probably several copies of, you won't find that year there, because when Francis Paulette did his editing job, he didn't know that that particular year still existed. And so what I'll be talking about now is a particular kind of courtship. And first, to start with his initial marriage, and we can go to that fourth sheet on the handout that I've given you. This gives you most of the biographical data, the vital data of Ebenezer Parkman and what turns out to be a terribly large family. He's born, as I mentioned, in 1703 in Boston. He marries in 1724, shortly before his ordination in Westboro. He chooses as his bride Mary Champney of Cambridge, a woman who is several years, almost 5 years, older than he is. They live together in apparent great harmony. If one senses or one is looking for evidence of the love for one person by an individual, one can find good traces of this in Parkman's diary, those portions that survive for the period of his marriage. And every year, or virtually every year, on the anniversary of her death, he would set that day apart and talk about the wormwood and the gall. In other words, he would remember God's judgment upon his household in taking his beloved Mary from him. So she dies on January 29, 1736, after having borne five children to Ebenezer Parkman, one of whom, Lydia, the fourth child, was already dead. And so she leaves him with four young children. He then, in September of 1737, marries Hannah Breck. She is the daughter of Robert Breck, who was the minister of the neighboring town of Marlborough. And what is significant there, I think, to look at is the age disparity between the two of them. He's about 34 when he remarries. She is 21. And if you ever have a recipe for a demographic catastrophe on a minister's salary, that's clearly it. Because that meant that he had what amounted to half a family with his first wife, and then he starts all over again. And Hannah Breck bears him a total of 11 children, not counting her two miscarriages. And again, the miscarriages we would never know about except for the diary itself. This means, of course, that Ebenezer Parkman, if you're thinking in this cycle of parenthood, Ebenezer Parkman is a father down, or is conceiving children down into the time that he is in his late 50s, and he is a parent down almost to the time of his death. In other words, there was no empty nest for Ebenezer Parkman except at the very tail end of his life. I might point out a couple of other things on that table that I find particularly interesting. Note that the first daughter is named Mary after her mother. The first son is named Ebenezer after his father. Note, too, the relentless regularity of female fertility in the 18th century. That is, almost inevitably, this is going to be a two-year phenomenon. So that women of childbearing years in the 18th century or the 17th century or eons before that are either going to be pregnant or nursing or very briefly in between those two states. And so for a period from 1738 down to 1761, that is one of Hannah Brett Parkman's major responsibilities. Now turn, please, to the last page of the handout to give you some more data. These are data from colonial Andover, Massachusetts, but I think that probably we would find the same thing if we were to reconstruct the family histories in Westboro. They show the incident of single marriages, double marriages, triple marriages, and quadruple marriages. I think I said that wrong. But essentially, they point out how many men, because the focus is on men rather than women, how many men married only once, how many men married twice, how many men married three times, and how many men married four times. We do have an image, I think a popular image, handed down to us through a great deal of lore, that men frequently remarry in the colonial period. To an extent, it's certainly truer today, at least in terms of widows remarrying, truer then than it was, that is today. Certainly people remarry for other reasons much more frequently today than in the 18th century. But the data here, I think, are significant in that we have something on the order of 65 to 75% of the men are married only once, suggesting that the process of bereavement and remarriage is something that will affect only perhaps 25 to 30% of the males. In other words, there may be bereavement, but it will not be followed by remarriage for some 60, 70, 75% of the male population. Well, as I said, Ebenezer Parkman's first marriage to Mary Champney or Molly Champney was a very happy, although tragically concluded marriage. In January of 1736, members of his family fall ill. Molly herself becomes ill. And the diary records this very sad sense. And I wish I knew whether he was writing it all at once or day by day or writing it retrospectively, because there's a point in this where he knows that there is no hope. So the diary records the fevers that she experiences, the visits of Dr. Gott from Marlborough, the efforts to pray. There's even a very interesting incident in which she has a fever, and if any of you is a physician, you can answer this for me. A fowl, that is, presumably a chicken, is placed on her feet. I have no idea what's going on there. But presumably, if there is some folk lore or some sense that this warm, feathered animal will, in fact, do something medicinally good for her. It does not. At one point in her delirium, she hears angels singing, and then on January 29th, she dies. As Parkman exclaimed in the privacy of his diary, and again, this is a private rather than a public person, even the wife of my covenant, the wife of my bosom, the wife of my youth, and the desire of my eyes was taken away by the stroke of death. Well, what do? I have not experienced that yet, bereavement. And I hope I don't for a long time. But there is a certain number of practical problems that one necessarily must confront in a situation like this. That is, who do you notify? What do you do with the kids? How do you put your life back into some kind of semblance of order so that meals get on the table and that the business of life can go on? Well, as in many cases, and I'm sure this would be typical of today, neighbors and townspeople come to his assistance. Writers go off to other parts of New England to tell the sad news of her death. Yet at the same time that Parkman is grieving internally, privately, personally, he also has a public role to play. That is, this is the town's minister. This is the man who is the exemplar of all the values of the culture. How are you to act on an occasion like this? Well, Edmund Morgan, who is a professor of history down at Yale, has written a great deal about the 17th century Puritan family. And this is what he says with respect to love and attachment and mourning within the context of a marriage. Ministers warned husbands and wives that their love for each other required moderation. The highest love of all Christians was reserved for God himself. And since human beings, husbands and wives, were only the creatures of God, they could not take his place. Every benefit and comfort obtained from them, came ultimately from him. To prize them too highly was to upset the order of creation and descend to idolatry. And Morgan goes on to observe, when a widow or widower showed immoderate grief, he showed that he valued a creature too highly. In other words, your eye should be on the creator rather than the creature. Your eye should be on the eternal rather than the temporal. Your eye should be on the infinite rather than the finite. Well, through the diary, we can trace what is going on in Parkman's life. Molly dies on a Thursday, and next Sunday is the Sabbath. What do you do on that particular occasion? Normally, what would happen is that a minister from the neighboring town would probably come in to assist Parkman at that time of particular crisis. And as things turned out, no minister was available. And so 4 days after his wife's death, he has to get up in the pulpit and preach both the morning and the afternoon sermon. I know not how to undertake anything, but God called for it. Weeping must not hinder sowing. In other words, his grief must not displace the sowing of the word of God. And I went forth with some old preparations, that is, we got an old sermon out of his file, and repeated my sermon on Hebrews 12:5. The text was not one that he just jerked out of his file. Rather, this was a text from the Bible which meant a great deal under the occasion. That is something that all people could understand. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. In other words, do not reject the Lord because he has brought his rebuke upon him. Parkman kept his composure. He was able to preach his sermon so shortly after his wife's death. As he writes in his diary, it was observable how God tied up my affections and restrained my tears and carried me through all without those confusions I feared and expected. Well, that's one challenge that he had to go through and would continue to have to go through Sunday after Sunday. But what about the day of her burial? In the morning, this is the day of her funeral, in the morning I very much dreaded the work of this day. I feared I should discover, by discover he meant reveal, I feared I should discover and publish my infirmities in open indecencies. I endeavored therefore to beware and to set myself before him. In other words, to tie back the emotions, to hold back the tears. Well, he continues in this process of what we could call public mourning, because every Sunday, dressed in black, he's up in the pulpit, preaching from texts that are not arbitrarily chosen, but rather worked through the process of God's judgment, his own sorrow, and the duty of Christians. And thus, on the second Sunday after Molly's death, he noted, "I had nobody to preach for me. I prepared what I could in the midst of the broken, heavy thoughts of the week." His text was Ezekiel 24:16. "Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke. Yet neither shalt thou mourn nor weep, neither shall thy tears run down." And again, he returns to those same kinds of texts week after week. At the same time, publicly he's saying that kind of things, but privately, of course, he's in a turmoil. The days and nights